Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. I have just finished an exhausting series on filicide, a mother who viciously stabbed her little boys. I definitely wanted to cover something different, but didn't immediately realize that I chose an almost exact opposite case of matricide, of a young woman who viciously murdered her own mother. Leslie Jane Ballard had grown up as the very loved, pampered, and even spoiled daughter of Lester and Janie Ballard, a prominent couple in Little Rock, Arkansas. She had also led a very sheltered life, Catholic schoolgirl, then an accomplished college graduate, before joining the family business. But everything changed when she met Mike McCool. Leslie had been drifting in her life, unmoored by her rigid school days, and Mike seemed so cool, so masculine. He was flashy, confident, and absolutely everything her parents did not want in a son-in-law. Leslie didn't know it, but he was lazy and a habitual liar with a very checkered criminal past, though he always managed to avoid prison. Mike McCool was the exact opposite of the good girl, Leslie Ballard. And yet when they met, it was like two magnets drawn together. Did he force Leslie, who had been very close to both of her parents, to murder her mother? Or did Leslie, in a fit of rage, kill her mother over her late father's considerable estate? It was left up to two juries to decide. And now you can decide for yourself. Welcome to episode 142, Mike and Leslie McCool. Little Rock, Arkansas sits on the banks of the Arkansas River in Pulaski County, located in the center of the state. And with a population of nearly 200,000 people, it's the largest city in Arkansas. The city's name comes from a rock formation along the river named Little Rock, or La Petite Roche, by the French explorer Jean-Baptiste Bernard de La Harpe in the 1720s. The city of Little Rock was incorporated just over 100 years later. It was used as a landmark with early river traffic and became a well-known river crossing. It's across the river from a large bluff on the edge of the river called the Big Rock, which was once used as a rock quarry and marked the transition from the flat Mississippi Delta region to the Washita Mountain foothills. Native Americans inhabited central Arkansas for thousands of years before Europeans arrived. Historic tribes of the area were the Caddo, Quapaw, Osage, Choctaw, and Cherokee. Little Rock has a humid subtropical climate with hot humid summers and mild winters with usually a little snow. The capital city is home to the William J. Presidential Library and Museum for our 42nd president and former governor of Arkansas, Bill Clinton. It's a very diverse area, with 52% of residents being white and 47% black, with smaller Asian and Native American communities. The River Market District is the hub of Little Rock, featuring restaurants, shops, bars, nightlife, museums, and hotels, as well as the area's main library. Little Rock is also home to the Arkansas Museum of Fine Arts, the Arkansas Repertory Theater, and the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra. Little Rock has plenty for outdoor lovers as well, with great weather and numerous city parks offering pedestrian trails, bike paths, fishing, private and public golf courses, sports facilities, and picnic areas. During the time of today's case, Little Rock's population wasn't much smaller at around 188,000 residents. In September 2003, located at 603 West Markham Street in downtown Little Rock, sat Shepherd's Inc., a printing and engineering architectural supply firm. The business, originally named Little Rock Blueprint Company, had been there since at least the 1950s, and after the owner passed away in the 80s, it was purchased by Janie and Lester Ballard, a local Little Rock couple. Born and raised in Arkansas, Lester got a job working as a paperboy at the Blueprint Company in the 50s after dropping out of high school. While working his way up at the company, Lester started a family with his first wife, Marie. Together, they had a son named Davy in January of 1954, but a little over a year later, they separated. In 1958, Lester remarried, and that relationship also ended in divorce. On June 8, 1975, 41-year-old Lester married 30-year-old Janie Lee Connor in Las Vegas. Janie was also from Arkansas. She was born there in August of 1945 and graduated from Little Rock Central High School, and then went on to work as a secretary for an advertising agency. On July 22, 1976, just over a year after their marriage, Lester and Janie welcomed a baby girl into their one-story wooden brick home in the 3500 block of Cedar Hill Road in Little Rock. A combination of both of her parents' names, Leslie Jane was everything the newlywed couple wanted in a child. She was their pride and joy, their entire world, and Leslie adored them back. While she was always close to her mom, she was a daddy's girl at heart. Family friend Chuck Lang told the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, "The sun rose and set with that girl." Another family friend, Jay Yates, said, "You can't imagine how close these three people were. These people doted on each other." The Ballards had pictures of Leslie, some as large as posters, plastered around the family home and at the business. Lester and Janie would do anything to provide their daughter with the ideal upbringing. So when the owner of the Little Rock Blueprint Company passed away and the company went up for sale, the Ballards took a leap and purchased the business, renaming it Shepherd's. With Lester's 30 years of experience working at the company, and Janie's secretarial and customer service skills, the Ballards were very successful. The business was lucrative, and they were able to live a comfortable life, not wanting for anything. And most importantly, Janie and Lester were able to provide their precious daughter Leslie with the best of everything. Private schools, cars, vacations, you name it, Leslie got it. But the Ballards as a whole were very conservative. They didn't flaunt their money, and although Leslie always got what she asked for, she didn't come off as a spoiled brat. Instead, she was shy, withdrawn, and kept to herself. The neighborhood parents adored Leslie and found her to be a darling little girl, as one put it. All the neighborhood kids loved Leslie too, partly because she had all the toys in the world. To everyone on the outside, the Ballard family was perfect. They were exactly what many picture when thinking of the ideal family. But like so many families, behind closed doors, they were extremely dysfunctional. Both Lester and Janie were alcoholics, and their drinking often led to fighting, which Leslie witnessed. I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. Leslie later said she felt very isolated and alone during her formative years. She was close to her parents, and she knew a lot of people due to her parents being well-known in the community, but she was sheltered, and she didn't feel like she had any friends of her own. Lester's drinking got so bad that Janie filed for divorce in January of 1982. After the divorce was final, Janie started dating a man named Gene Douglas, who was 13 years older than her. Janie married Gene Douglas in May 1985, but they soon divorced. And then Janie and Lester got back together, and the Ballard family was whole again. Things were great for a while, until August 1988, when Lester's 34-year-old son from his first marriage, Davy, was charged with three counts of distribution and conspiracy to distribute methamphetamine. The arrest was a result of an 18-month federal investigation conducted by the DEA. Starting in 1985, Davy and six others had been picking up meth in California, transporting it back to Arkansas, and then distributing it. Davy faced 60 years in federal prison, but after working with investigators, he was sentenced to only 15 months. After he was released, Davy started working at the printing company with his dad and stepmom and began turning his life around. Sadly, he passed away 3 years later at the age of 38. His obituary listed no cause of death. In 1990, Leslie started high school at Mount St. Mary Academy, a private Catholic all-girls school. A classmate later described her as a typical teenager. Leslie was known as being quiet, but she had a spunky nature and a bit of a temper. She was called, quote, a cute, well-mannered girl. Any guy would have been proud to take her home to mama. In 1994, Leslie graduated from high school. In her yearbook, where parents sent in dedications, Janie wrote, quote, a miracle happened to your dad and I on July 22, 1976. You were born. You are all that a daughter should be. Love you always, Mom and Dad. Following her graduation, Leslie left for home for the first time and attended Westminster College in Missouri. She wanted to get a business degree so she could join the family business. Janie and Lester were elated to hear of her plans. Having their daughter as part of the team would be a dream come true. After a year, Leslie transferred to the University of Arkansas at Fayetteville, which delighted her parents, who missed having their only child close to home. While Leslie worked on her degree, she and her mom spent every weekend together, going shopping and on lunch dates. When Leslie graduated with her bachelor's, she wasn't done yet. She stayed to work on a master's in business administration. She was a very smart girl with an IQ of 119, so it was no surprise to anyone when she graduated within a year. She moved back home, ready to take on a role at the print shop. Janie and Lester were extremely proud of Leslie. They wanted to reward her hard work, so they bought her a new car and a condo not far from her childhood home. They also offered Leslie a generous salary. Leslie later said that this point in her life was the golden period. Things had stabilized in the Ballard home, and her parents weren't drinking or fighting. And at the business, Leslie and Janie worked very well together. And while they'd always been close, Leslie truly felt like they had become best friends. Even though her home and work life were going well, Leslie still started to feel an emptiness inside of her. She'd been focused on her education for so long that she didn't know what to pour her energy into now that she was done. She decided to go with fitness and joined the Little Rock Athletic Club. In August 2000, 24-year-old Leslie was doing some crunches when a bodybuilder walked up to her, introduced himself as 36-year-old Mike McCool, and said, "You sure are pretty." That pickup line may have been a little lame, but the lonely Leslie was instantly drawn to Mike. He didn't look like any of the boys she'd gone to school with. He had a dark tan and long hair, and while he was short at 5'6", he was very muscular, weighing in at around 200 pounds. And that's not all. Mike was very flashy. Leslie later said, quote, "You could see him coming from a mile away, and it all screamed, 'I've got money.' He wore expensive sunglasses and jewelry and drove fancy sports cars. He was brash and spontaneous," which was the complete opposite of Leslie, who was soft-spoken and articulate. Born on October 19, 1953, Michael Raymond McCool was really 46 years old. He had lied about his age by a decade. In many ways, he had a similar upbringing to Leslie. He wasn't an only child, having a sister and brother, but Mike's family was wealthy like Leslie's. His father, LJ, was an investment banker and a world-famous trick shot archer. His mother, Pat, was in the baking business. But unlike Leslie, Mike was not submissive to his parents. In fact, he liked to live life on the edge and was always hurting himself or getting into trouble. Mike managed to make it to his senior year at Hall High School in Little Rock before his first serious brush with the law. On January 8, 1972, 18-year-old Mike was brought in for questioning over the death of a young teen named Jeff Ward, who had died earlier that morning. Mike told police that on the night of January 7th, he and a friend were riding around in his dad's Cadillac and stopped for gas. As they were leaving, three boys, 14-year-old Jeff Ward and two of his friends, both 15-year-old boys, asked for a ride to a former teacher's house. Mike said okay, and they all hopped in. During the drive, the three boys were drinking apple wine, and Jeff got sick in the back seat. Mike asked Jeff if he had thrown up, and he said no, but Mike turned around and saw that Jeff had stuff all over his mouth. He rolled the window down to give Jeff some air and kept driving until he reached a service station. Once they were parked, they all piled out of the car, and Mike got a good look at all of the vomit in the back seat. He was mad Jeff had lied to him, so he walked over to him and punched him once in the head. Jeff fell to the ground and hit his head on a brick planter. Mike told the police, quote, "I tried to pick him up. He wouldn't get up. His eyes were closed. So I kicked him in the right shoulder to wake him up, but he still laid there." Mike and his friend took off, leaving the boys there. Jeff did wake up, and they all started walking to the teacher's house. Once there, the boys ended up staying the night with the teacher because it was late and Jeff wasn't feeling well. During the night, Jeff woke up twice to talk to them, but by the early morning, he started having trouble breathing and his heart was beating rapidly. The teacher called for an ambulance, and Jeff was taken to the hospital, where he died of a brain hemorrhage. Investigators spoke with Mike and all four people who had been with him that evening. All of their stories were the same. Jeff vomited in the back seat, Mike got mad, punched him once, and Jeff hit his head on the planter. But he hadn't meant to kill the boy. 18-year-old Mike was originally charged with first-degree murder anyway, but the charge was later lowered to involuntary manslaughter. In July 1972, after speaking with the Ward and McCool families, a judge dismissed the charges against Mike with the agreement that he'd enlist in the Marines. Mike dropped out of high school and followed through and was shipped off to California, where he served for the next 5 years. During his time there was when Mike started bodybuilding. He liked the way the muscles changed his appearance from scrawny to buff. He felt much more confident with his small stature. After finishing up his stint in the Marines, Mike moved back home to Little Rock. There, his parents, quote, "gave him the world," according to letters from Mike to the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. They bought him a motorcycle and multiple sports cars, including a Dodge Viper and a Chevy Corvette. Over the next 20 years, Mike would go on to start many businesses, some with his father, including USA Racing, Inc., and Pleasant Valley Landscape. He didn't always work full-time. Sometimes he just lived off loans from his parents. Other times he broke the law or ran cons on people. In 1978, 24-year-old Mike married his first of four wives, a 21-year-old nurse named Julia. 3 years later, he was arrested for felony theft after he tried to steal several hundred dollars worth of lumber from a lumber yard. Mike had purchased 36 pieces for $71, but before he went out to the pickup area, he altered his receipt to say he purchased 360 pieces and started trying to load that many in his truck. The yard employee figured it out and called the police. Mike was just fined and sentenced to 12 months of probation. Mike and Julia divorced in 1984. And the next year, 31-year-old Mike married a 24-year-old woman named Gail. Within a year, Mike was arrested for writing a bad check and was sentenced to just 3 years of probation. In December 1989, around the time his probation ended, Mike approached the owner of Gold's Gym where he worked out and asked him if he would be interested in selling the place for a few hundred thousand dollars. It was an offer the owner couldn't refuse. They made a deal, where Mike would end up being a part owner as well as the manager. He was supposed to make his first payment of $30,000 on January 31, 1990. But January 31st came and went, and the owner didn't see a dime of the $30,000. In fact, Mike had actually vacated the building and had withdrawn all the money from the owner's business accounts, which was around $400,000. The Gold's Gym owner sued Mike, and later that year, Mike McCool filed for bankruptcy for debts of $756,000. And it wouldn't be the last time he filed for bankruptcy. In 1991, Mike and his second wife, Gail, divorced, and 37-year-old Mike started dating a 21-year-old woman named Tina. Soon, Tina was pregnant, and they were expecting a baby girl together. In 1994, Tina had been babysitting for a male neighbor at his house when Mike barged in and accused her of having an affair. After screaming and yelling at Tina and the neighbor for a while, Mike went home, where he had left their toddler daughter, and grabbed his gun and fired a few shots from the porch. He then barricaded himself and his daughter in the home. The police were called, and when Officer Everett Davis showed up, Mike was on the phone with Tina. Davis heard Mike threaten to kill Tina and their daughter, so he asked him to come out of the house and talk, but Mike refused and told Davis not to come inside. He said he had a safe full of guns and that he would use them if he had to. This began a standoff with police, and Mike did not surrender for 5 hours. He was charged with 2 counts of terroristic threatening, which he pled guilty to and was sentenced to just 5 years probation. This was a serious crime, and I cannot believe he only got probation, especially considering his record. And Tina and Mike actually stayed together after this. And then the next year, 1995, Mike was sentenced to 6 years probation again for writing another bad check. But in 1996, he married Tina, and in 1997, they welcomed a son. By November of 1999, Mike was back to his swindling ways. He went to the customer service counter at Home Depot and tried to return some stolen items. He was wearing a police hat and flashed a fake badge at the employees. They called the police, and Mike was arrested for theft, criminal impersonation, and criminal attempt. He was sentenced to 1 year of probation and 30 days of jail to just be served on the weekends. In January of 2000, there is a heavy winter storm, during which Mike lit a bonfire in the middle of the street. He was arrested for public intoxication and fined. The next month, Mike and Tina separated, and she filed an order of protection against Mike, stating that he stalked, threatened, and harassed her and their 2 children. The protection order was granted and later extended through April of 2001. I'm going to pause now to hear a word from today's sponsors. Ah, February. Love is in the air. And you know who really deserves some love? Your brain. Best Fiends is my favorite way to treat my brain to a much-needed recharge. I play Best Fiends with my stepdaughter. She's not living at home anymore, so it's a fun way to stay connected. Best Fiends is a mobile puzzle game that anyone can download and play, whether you have a few minutes or a few hours. Best Fiends is the perfect puzzle game to help you unwind. It features tons of cute characters who help you solve thousands of fun puzzles. The more you play, the more characters you collect, and the more you win, the more challenges you face. My favorite character right now is Whisper, who was born a yellow jacket but wishes she was a bee. And challenging puzzles are added all the time. There are tons of fun events where you can win huge rewards. Right now, I am continuing my adventure through the Season of Caesar to win rewards all through February. With thousands of levels, Best Fiends has all the me time you need. Ready to give your brain some TLC? Download Best Fiends free today on the App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. For fans of true crime podcasts, Generation Y is essential listening. Hosts Aaron and Justin cover cases from all angles. They break down theories, deep dives into forensic evidence, and discuss their opinions on the most perplexing cases. In a recent episode, Aaron and Justin look into the case of funeral home owner Dan O'Connell and his intern, James Ellison, who were both found shot to death in Dan's office. The murders went unsolved. Years later, while investigating a separate case, detectives interviewed a Catholic priest, Father Ryan Erickson, and he revealed information only the killer and detectives knew about the double murder. Then, Father Ryan hanged himself. With their only suspect now dead, police in the community grappled with the questions left. Did a Catholic priest kill 2 men? And if so, why? I've been a fan of Gen Y for many years, dating back to my time as a commuter when they were one of the only true crime podcasts out there. 2022 is shaping up to be one of their most exciting seasons yet, and I can't wait to see Aaron and Justin at CrimeCon again. Listen to the Generation Y podcast on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, or you can listen ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app. Without Tina, Mike kept doing his thing, working on and off, taking money from his parents, and bodybuilding at the gym. And that's exactly what he was doing in August of 2000 when he met 24-year-old Leslie at the gym. Within a month of meeting each other, Mike offered to help Leslie with an exercise and diet program, and she took him up on the offer. She figured Mike looked great and clearly knew what to do, so why not? Leslie found Mike to be funny and charming. She later said, "When he talked to you, he made you feel like you were the only person around. He made me feel special and beautiful and smart." Leslie also liked Mike's tough guy image. He loved fast cars, dirt bikes, motorcycles, skiing, and martial arts. He was unlike anybody she'd ever been with. She had only ever dated what she called safe boys, or rather, the conservative Catholic boys her parents preferred. And of course, Leslie liked that Mike was a bad boy. However, it's unclear if she knew the extent of his criminal history, and considering he lied about something as simple as his age, I think it's safe to say she didn't know everything. On October 19th, 2000, Leslie and Mike had dinner to celebrate what he said was his 37th birthday, even though he was really 47. That night, they were intimate for the first time and were inseparable from then on. In December, Mike moved into the condo Leslie's parents had bought her for graduation. They spent the Christmas, New Year's holiday skiing in Steamboat Springs, Colorado. According to Snapped Killer Couples, during this trip, Mike did things in bed that Leslie had never experienced before. She had truly been a conservative Catholic girl, and none of her boyfriends had been this experienced sexually. Mike opened up a whole world of possibilities, and Leslie wanted every single one of them. From this point on, Leslie would do anything for Mike. She became subservient to him, much like she had her parents. Leslie and Mike started lavishly spending her trust fund and generous salary. They went on fancy vacations and made extravagant purchases like furs, watches, sports cars, motorcycles. Whatever Mike thought they needed, she provided. Mike soon let Leslie know that he liked his women to look like a perfect 10, which to him meant bleach blonde hair, big boobs, and revealing tight clothing. I swear, y'all, I didn't pick a murderess this eerily similar to Darlie on purpose. Haley chose this topic. But anyway, all of Mike's previous three wives had looked this way, and Mike wanted Leslie to as well. So, she started going to the salon, where a stylist would bleach her brown hair. She also got breast implants and started wearing short shorts and half skirts. Gone was the conservative Catholic girl. Here to stay was the sexually awakened woman. As you can imagine, Leslie's parents, Lester and Janie, did not approve of Mike McCool. They wanted Leslie to marry a good Catholic boy her own age, not some older, unemployed gym rat. He wasn't good enough for their precious daughter. She was 24 years old to his supposed 37 years. He was really almost twice her age. The Ballards felt like there was something off about Mike, so they looked into his background and found out about his criminal and financial history. Lester and Janie were not shy about their distaste for their daughter's boyfriend. They told Leslie about Mike's background, but she didn't care. She was happy and in love, and wasn't that enough? But it wasn't. The Ballards were adamant that they didn't want Leslie to be with Mike. Family friend Jay Yates later said they disapproved of Mike so greatly that it was hard to be kind about him. This really drove a wedge between Leslie and her parents, who she had always been so close to. Leslie also stopped working for the family business, which meant she lost her salary, but she did still have her trust fund and savings. In the spring of 2001, Mike filed for divorce from his third wife, Tina. Discussions about custody of their children, now 10 and 4, turned nasty quickly. Remember, Tina had a restraining order against Mike for his stalking and threatening behavior. She was most concerned about leaving her children with their abusive father. Mike and Leslie's relationship started to struggle as well. In early December 2001, Mike filed for an order of protection, stating that Leslie told him, quote, "Don't be surprised if you never wake up." He also claimed she had multiple personalities and that one of them was named Candy, which Mike said is what Leslie named the Black Widow spider tattoo on her back. The order was dismissed the day after a judge found no evidence that Leslie was abusing or threatening Mike. The couple got back together, and on May 11, 2001, Leslie and Mike eloped and got married at the Hot Springs Mountain Tower. It wasn't exactly the fourth wedding Mike had dreamed of. He had originally asked the minister to marry them as they stood in the back of Mike's Corvette while riding down the highway. The minister managed to talk Mike out of this, and they settled on the mountain tower. Leslie was 26, and Mike was still lying about his age being 38. Even the newspaper announcement for their wedding listed his incorrect age. Leslie's parents were devastated when they heard their daughter had gotten married without telling them. They were also worried that Mike would take Leslie's condo in a divorce. They asked Leslie to sign the condo over to them. She could keep living there with Mike, but it could no longer be in her name. It might sound controlling, but they knew their sheltered daughter couldn't see Mike McCool for what he really was. Leslie felt betrayed by her parents' request, but she signed it over anyway. She soon fell into a deep depression and became almost completely estranged from her parents. The more Leslie thought about how she signed the condo over, the more depressed she became. On September 16th, she wrote a suicide letter that read, "Mike, if you're reading this letter, then I'm probably dead. I don't want to live anymore because of what my parents have done to me. It seems like everyone I thought cared about me is just out to screw me over. I'm just giving up. Because no matter what I do, I either get stabbed in the back by my family or I mess it up." After writing the letter, Leslie cut her wrists with an X-Acto knife. Mike found her, and she was transported to the hospital, where the injuries were found to be superficial, but she was held for a 72-hour evaluation. A month later, Mike and Leslie booked a $15,000 skiing trip to Steamboat Springs on the printing company's credit card. When Lester and Janie found out, they were speechless. It was the last straw. Any remnant of the daughter they raised was clearly gone. In November, after getting back from vacation, Leslie sued her mom for fraud, stating that Janie coerced her into signing the condo she owned over to her parents. Janie countered, saying she only talked Leslie into signing over the condo because they were worried Mike would get it if they divorced. In February 2003, Leslie dropped her lawsuit after Janie and her parents paid her $50,000 in a settlement. Leslie and Mike immediately cashed the check and continued spending money recklessly. Following the lawsuit, Lester, who had been sober for many years, started drinking again. He was also suffering from liver disease and Alzheimer's, and his health quickly started to decline. But Leslie didn't know her dad was sick. At this point, she was completely estranged from her parents. She didn't find out until she spoke to Janie's best friend, Betty, who often played messenger between the family members. In mid-July, Lester was admitted to hospice due to complications from pneumonia. Betty called Leslie to let her know that her father was going to die soon, but Leslie didn't go visit. Instead, she and Mike packed some suitcases, grabbed their new caged python, and hopped in the Corvette and drove to Florida. On August 19th, Lester passed away. Janie didn't call her daughter to inform her, but Betty did. However, Leslie and Mike were still in Florida, where cell reception was spotty. Betty wasn't able to get the call through. 10 days later, Leslie called hospice to see how her dad was doing, but they refused to tell her anything, so she called Betty in a huff. Betty shared the sad news, and Leslie screamed, then hung up the phone. She soon called back and asked when the funeral was, and Betty told her it had been held on the 21st. Leslie was completely gutted. This former daddy's girl had missed her own father's funeral. Leslie called her mom and asked her to put aside one of Lester's shirts and some photographs. She then suggested they meet when she and Mike got home, but they had wrecked their Corvette and were waiting for it to be fixed. As soon as it was done, they would head back. Janie said okay, and they made plans to meet on September 7th at the Ballard home. Once the car was repaired, Leslie, Mike, and their Python drove back to Little Rock. On the 7th, Leslie went over to her mom's place as planned. She went alone because she knew her mom wouldn't open the door if Mike was with her. As soon as she got inside her childhood home, Leslie was shocked to find that Janie had put up new wallpaper and adorned the walls with knickknacks, something Lester never allowed. Leslie sarcastically snapped at her mom, "Quite the grieving widow, aren't you?" Leslie moved on and asked if Janie saved the shirt and photos she wanted, but Janie said she'd gotten rid of everything already. Leslie couldn't believe it. Her dad died only 19 days before. Janie and Leslie started arguing, and when Lester's will came up, Janie dropped a bombshell. Lester had changed his will after Leslie married Mike. She would no longer get $750,000. Now she would only get $25,000, while almost everything else went to her mother. Knowing her dad's estate was estimated at $2.4 million, this was a major slap in the face for Leslie. She went home to Mike and told him what happened. The next day, Leslie met with Lester's estate attorney to discuss her inheritance. She agreed not to contest the $25,000 payout and asked when she would get the check. The attorney told her it would take some time to get it all together, so Leslie left and went home. As Mike read a copy of the will, a certain clause popped out to him. If Janie died within 30 days of Lester, everything would go to Leslie. Mike told Leslie they should kill Janie so she could inherit the entire $2.4 million estate. At first, Leslie said no, but Mike wore her down and she agreed. So they started discussing what weapon to use. They argued over if a gun or knife would be better, and eventually settled on a knife because it was harder to trace. With the murder weapon picked out, Mike purchased an 8-inch high-quality butcher knife. Then they came up with the rest of the plan. Leslie would dress in a black turtleneck, black pants, oversized shoes, gloves, face paint, and a ski mask. Mike would drop Leslie off at her mom's house just before she normally arrived home from work. Leslie would ambush Janie, stab her in a few vital organs, and stage a burglary. Then Leslie would put on an afro wig, steal her mom's car, and meet Mike in a predominantly black neighborhood. That way, if anyone saw something, they would think the suspect was a black person. Then they planned to get rid of the evidence and wait for their multi-million-dollar payout. On the morning of September 12th, it had been 24 days since Lester died, and Mike and Leslie had only 6 days left to kill Janie, so they decided to carry out their plan. Leslie got dressed, and Mike dropped her off at Janie's and said he would wait across the street in the park. Leslie waited in the bushes near her mom's garage. Around 15 to 20 minutes later, Janie pulled into the driveway and opened the garage. After she unlocked the door to the house, Leslie snuck up behind her mom and told her to keep quiet. They struggled, and Janie tried to get to a phone, but Leslie grabbed it and smashed it over her head. As Janie fought back against her daughter, Leslie stabbed her mom in the kidneys and lungs. Janie fell to the ground, and then Leslie straddled her back and stabbed her repeatedly. When Janie stopped moving, Leslie cut the phone line and started rifling through drawers to make it look like a burglary gone wrong. She grabbed some of her mom's jewelry and her dad's coin collection for good measure. Then she put on the afro wig and stole her mom's Cadillac. Leslie met up with Mike at the pre-planned meeting location, abandoned the car, and went back home. In the backyard, Leslie took her clothes off and washed off, and then they headed to Mike's parents' house in Hot Springs, where they planned to burn the evidence. Meanwhile, Janie's friend, Mickey Holloway, a crime scene specialist for the Little Rock Police Department, tried to call Janie, but got no answer. Mickey was worried, so at around 6 a.m. on the morning of September 13th, Mickey decided to stop by Janie's to see if she was okay. He used a garage door opener Janie had given him. As soon as the garage was open, Mickey knew something was wrong. Janie's Cadillac was missing, and the door to the home was open. When he walked in, he found 58-year-old Janie Ballard in the living room, laying on her back, with her hands above her head, one shoe on her foot, the other under an ottoman. It was a vicious, bloody attack. The crime scene photos are horrific. Janie had been stabbed more than 70 times, and her neck had been slit post-mortem. There were 11 cuts and slashes to the back of her head, the longest of which was more than 4 inches long. There were 16 wounds to the top of her head, two of which actually penetrated her skull. There were 13 stab wounds to Janie's upper back, some where the knife went through the torso and out the chest. She also had extensive defensive wounds on her arms, which the medical examiner said were the worst he had seen in his 40-year career. Mickey Holloway called the police, and Officer Steve Dodge responded to the scene. At first, he thought Janie had been killed in a burglary gone wrong, but then he noted the amount of stab wounds. This was no burglary. This was overkill. This was emotional. This was personal. I'm going to pause now for a final word from today's sponsors. Today's episode is brought to you by BetterHelp Online Therapy. Relationships take work, and some of us forget that the most important relationship of your life is the one you have with yourself. You will probably drop anything to help someone you care about. Why is it we go out of our way to show up for others, but sometimes ignore our own needs? So this month, BetterHelp Online Therapy wants to remind you that you matter just as much as everyone else does, and that therapy is a great way to make sure you show up for yourself. Therapy has gotten me through some of the hardest times of my life, but also, I consider therapy like regular maintenance for my mind and my heart. And BetterHelp makes it so easy to stay in touch with myself and my needs. BetterHelp is online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can be matched with a therapist in under 48 hours. Give it a try and see why over 2 million people have used BetterHelp online therapy. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp, and Southern Fried True Crime listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/southern. That's BETTERHELP.com/southern. I love to set new goals for myself, personal to-do lists. On the top of my list right now is learning a new language with Babbel, the new learning app that sold more than 10 million subscriptions. Babbel teaches bite-sized language lessons for the real world. The 15-minute lessons make it a perfect way to learn a new language on the go. I studied French from high school to college, and I've always noticed I can pick up words in other romance languages. I'm using Babbel to learn Spanish. The app is so easy to navigate, and the lessons are fun and engaging. You can choose from 14 different languages, including Spanish, French, Italian, and German. There are so many ways to learn with Babbel. You can access podcasts, games, videos, stories, and live classes. Plus, it comes with a 20-day money-back guarantee. Right now, when you purchase a 3-month Babbel subscription, you'll get an additional 3 months for free. That's 6 months for the price of 3. Just go to Babbel.com and use promo code SFTC. That's BABBEL.com, code SFTC. Babbel, language for life. Officer Dodge spoke with Mickey Holloway, who said he thought Leslie and Mike should be looked into. Janie had told him multiple times that she was afraid Leslie and Mike would kill her for her money. In fact, she was so scared that she asked him to install an alarm system and check on her every day, once in the morning and once she got back from work. Janie had given him a set of keys and a garage door opener and showed him where she hid her expensive jewelry, which was in a small bowl hidden under the bathroom sink. She told him to look there if anything happened. Mickey added that Janie told him about meeting with Leslie on the 7th. Their argument confirmed her fears that her daughter wanted her dead. Meanwhile, Mike and Leslie were in Hot Springs, trying to sell the coin collection at a jeweler's. According to employee Deborah Adcock, the McCools stuck out in the store. Leslie was wearing short shorts, high heels, and a very revealing pink halter top. And Mike's shorts were even shorter, she said. But the jeweler didn't buy the coins, so Leslie and Mike looked around for a bit and then left without buying anything. Later, they drove back home, arriving before 9 p.m. Soon after, investigators showed up. The McCools were separated and told that Janie had been killed. According to an appeal document, after hearing what happened, Leslie had no reaction, but Mike reacted with loud sobbing and crying sounds and ran to embrace Leslie. They hugged for a few moments, and then Mike's emotions, quote, were cut off as quickly as they were turned on. When Mike turned to face the investigators, he hadn't actually shed a single tear. At the station, Mike and Leslie were once again separated. The investigators who spoke with Mike later said his demeanor was silly, goofy, arrogant, and manipulative. And it didn't seem like he cared at all that his mother-in-law had been brutally murdered. Mike told investigators that he'd only met Janie a few times and that she was nice to him, but he knew she didn't approve of his relationship with Leslie. When asked why, Mike said, "I don't know if it was the age difference. I don't know why. She never told me. I'm just guessing it's my record and I'm not good enough for her daughter." Mike said the last time Leslie saw her mom was around a week or so before, when she went to her mom's place to pick up some of her dad's things. When Leslie came home, she was upset because Janie had already destroyed a bunch of her dad's things. She had his coin collection and some photos, but that was it. An investigator asked Mike if Leslie received an inheritance after her father died, and Mike replied, "Don't ask me. I don't have no idea what's in the will for her, or what's hers, or what's not hers, or how much she's to get, or anything. I don't know." Mike finished up his statement by basically saying he and Leslie had been in Hot Springs, so they couldn't be responsible for the murders. The investigators didn't believe him, but they didn't have anything to hold him on yet, so they told him he was free to go. But Mike asked if he could stay and wait for Leslie, who was still being interviewed. They said sure, and he waited in the hallway on a bench where he napped, on and off, and at one point even made a paper airplane and flew it in the hallway. At the beginning of her interview, Leslie said she and Mike had a great relationship with Janie. She insisted they were not involved in her murder, but she knew some people who could be responsible. Her uncle, who didn't get along with Janie and was always asking for money, or an employee who is mad that Janie was allegedly going to sell the business. Investigators didn't believe Leslie and kept pressing her. Finally, she admitted to everything. She wanted to get it off her chest. Leslie said she was upset that Janie didn't tell her about her dad's death. She asked Janie to save a shirt and photos, but when she went over there on September 7th, Leslie found out Janie had pretty much erased Lester from existence. Leslie told investigators, quote, "I saw that she was in really good spirits. She was not grieving. I was. I was upset that she had not called me. I felt they could have waited longer for the funeral." She said, "When I saw how happy she was to be free, I was upset, angry, and told her that she should be happy now since she had everything and I had nothing." Leslie told investigators that after she informed Mike that her inheritance was now $25,000 and he saw the clause in the will, he suggested they kill Janie. Leslie didn't want to do it at first, but Mike was very controlling. She detailed their relationship from the beginning, saying, "He was very nice when I first met him, but he was very controlling soon after that." After they married, she said Mike became verbally and physically abusive. He slapped and punched her and pushed her down the stairs. He also called her names like bitch, whore, slut, fat, and ugly. But she said she stayed with him because she loved him. Leslie said Mike came up with a plan for her to kill Janie. When Leslie initially said no, he threw her against a wall and threatened to kill her and her mom if she told anyone or refused to do it. Finally, Leslie agreed because she thought she could use the money to leave Mike. On the morning of the murder, Mike woke Leslie up and told her they were going to her mom's. He picked out dark clothes, oversized shoes, gloves, and a ski mask for Leslie to wear. He drove Leslie to her mom's and handed her a backpack with a towel, wire cutters, and a butcher knife. He even reminded Leslie to stab Janie in the neck, kidneys, and lungs. Mike said he would wait across the street in a park. He was armed with a gun and would be watching. Leslie waited in the bushes for 15 to 20 minutes until Janie arrived home, and she said the whole time she was worried Mike would kill her and Janie if she didn't kill her mom first. Once Janie got home, Leslie followed her inside and pushed her down. Leslie told the investigators, quote, "I told her to keep quiet. There was a struggle. I really didn't want to hurt her, but I was afraid if I didn't, Mike would be very upset with me at the very least." Leslie said she remembered stabbing her mom 6 times. Then she staged the burglary and drove to the area where Mike said to meet. But he wasn't there, so she drove to a payphone and called him at home. Then she went back to the area and waited, and Mike showed up. Then they abandoned the car and drove home. Leslie cleaned off in the backyard while Mike bagged her bloody clothes. Then they drove to Mike's parents' house in Hot Springs. Mike started a fire in the fire pit and said he was going to burn Leslie's clothes, the backpack, and the knife. But then Mike got mad and said he'd probably have to kill her because of how bad of a job she did. Leslie said he changed his mind and said he might let her live so he could hold it over her head. Mike then revealed he wasn't going to burn Leslie's clothes after all. He actually left them at home so that he could have leverage against her. When she was finished confessing, investigators believed Leslie's story for the most part. So they went to the hallway and arrested Mike. They took him back to an interview room and read him his Miranda warnings. Mike said he wasn't going to talk, so investigators left the room. But it didn't take long for the suspense to get to Mike. Within 5 minutes, he knocked on the door and asked investigators what Leslie was saying about him. Detective John White told him she said he helped her. Mike responded that he didn't take part in or have anything to do with Janie being chopped up. The detective asked Mike how he knew that Janie had been chopped up, and he said he had heard it from other investigators in passing. But when he was asked to name the investigators, Mike couldn't answer. Detective White then said he no longer wanted to speak with Mike since he'd waived his rights. Mike asked White to come in the room so they could talk about personal matters and not the murder. White went back in the room and spoke to Mike for 10 or 15 minutes and then left. Not long after, Mike barricaded himself in the interview room, smashed a thermostat on the wall, and used a piece of metal to cut his wrists. He started crying, screaming, and yelling, which caught the attention of investigators outside the room. They pepper sprayed Mike to get him away from the door, then provided aid until an ambulance arrived. Mike was taken to the hospital and stitched up. There, he told Detective White that he wanted to talk to him. White said Mike could come back to the station when he was done at the hospital. Meanwhile, Leslie was taking detectives on a road trip to different areas she and Mike had been. During this trip, investigators said Leslie was cheerful, like she was part of the team. By the time they got to where the car had been abandoned, it had already been stolen. But at Mike's parents' place in Hot Springs, they did find a bag filled with jewelry and the burn pile where Mike had burned some evidence. When they were done with their trip, Leslie and the investigators went back to the station, and Leslie was charged with capital murder and theft of property. And Arkansas has the death penalty. Then she was transferred to the jail. After being treated, Mike was transported back to the police station by Officer John Bracey. According to an appeal document, during the ride, Mike had a conversation with Bracey, all of which was recorded. He said he knew the detectives wanted him to go back to the station because they wanted more statements from him. Bracey asked, "They want the truth this time?" And Mike replied, "Yep, they want that out of me." Bracey asked Mike if he was going to tell the truth this time, and Mike responded no, and then followed up with, quote, "I'm going to tell the truth, but I want my attorney there." A few minutes later, Mike asked, "Can you kill the music while I ask you something?" Bracey replied, "Yeah, sure, what's up?" Mike said, "I don't really know if you'll tell me the truth or not, but I'm going to ask you anyway." Mike then asked Bracey if he should be up front with the police, and Bracey told him yes, that's what he would do, but that he couldn't tell Mike what to do. Mike continued talking about whether or not to tell the truth, and Bracey asked, "Would you have asked me that question if you were not guilty?" Mike replied, "Probably no. Ain't got no reason to." Clearly, Bracey was dealing with an extremely sophisticated criminal mind. Later in the conversation, when the two were talking about what Leslie might be saying to the police, Mike said, "She's the one who can cry and trying to say I made her do it. You know, that's just a bunch of bull." In the interview room, investigators read Mike his rights again. Mike repeated that he had nothing to do with Janie's murder. All he did was agree to drive Leslie over to Janie's place so she could pick up a car there. When Leslie was ready to go, she was wearing all black and had a backpack. He asked why, and she said she didn't want to be recognized. Mike said this made no sense to him, so he asked her why, but he said he couldn't remember Leslie's response. He said after he dropped her off at Janie's, he went back home and waited for Leslie to call him to pick her up. 2 hours later, Leslie called him in a panic mode and told him to come get her in the Forsh Dam area. She gave him directions. And when he got there, she hopped out of her mom's Cadillac carrying two bags and ran over to his truck. Leslie got into the truck and said, "Let's get out of here. I've been driving around for 2 hours." Mike asked her what happened, and Leslie said she and her mom got into a fight and she ended up stabbing her, stole her jewelry, coin collection, and car. Leslie told Mike that she wanted to keep him out of it completely because she knew he had two kids. Leslie said, "It's my responsibility," he claimed. Mike cried as he told this to investigators. Quote, "She said she killed her mother. I don't know what to friggin' do. What am I supposed to do? Just bring her over here and say, 'Hey guys, she's just killed her mother'?" Mike said that while Leslie washed off in the backyard, he hid some of her clothing and attire for leverage. He was afraid she would try to frame or kill him, and he wanted to be able to tell detectives, "I've got this to show you what she did, and I didn't do it because of her DNA. Then Mike and Leslie went to his parents' place in Hot Springs, where he claimed Leslie burned two duffel bags in a burn pile and threw the knife in a nearby lake. After disposing of the evidence, he said Leslie reminded him, "You didn't do it, it was all my idea, and I'm going to take responsibility, and if we get caught because it was my idea, I did it." Mike wrapped up his statement to police saying, "You know, she's down there trying to make me the bad guy, the victim, the planner, whatever. I mean, if I want money, all I got to do is go cash my cashier's checks, go sell a couple of cars, go do whatever, sell my house, just move away." When investigators asked Mike about Leslie's allegations that he was controlling, Mike said, "Women have always controlled me. I gave them everything I could because that's how I show my love." Investigators did not believe Mike. They thought he was trying to put all the blame on Leslie. He was charged with capital murder and theft of property and transported to the same jail Leslie was already in. Now they were both facing the death penalty. On September 15th, Leslie and Mike both pled not guilty to all charges. When Mike went before the court, District Judge Lee Munson told him, quote, "I see you finally made the big time. You've been coming in here for years." Mike replied, "I didn't kill her, that's for sure." The judge set bond at $1 million for Mike and $500,000 for Leslie. The full amount had to be paid, not just the 10%. Later, their trials would be separated, and Leslie would file for divorce, stating that Mike treated her with, quote, "such general indignities that life had been made intolerable." After the divorce was final, Leslie went back to her maiden name. When details of Janie's brutal murder were made public, residents of Little Rock were in shock. Janie was a pillar of the community. A quick search of newspaper archives brings up numerous articles about generous things Janie had done, like donating her time and money for a cause she believed in, or participating in organizations like the Neighborhood Watch Group. Janie's friend and employee, Betty Sisko, told the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, quote, "She would give you the shirt off her back, literally. She was a very, very sweet person." But the shock didn't just stem from the fact that Janie was a well-liked person. It was also from knowing that Janie's own daughter had been the killer. The community had always looked at Leslie Ballard as the quintessential good Catholic girl. It was unfathomable to even think she could have been involved. On September 22nd at 1 p.m., funeral services for Janie Lee Ballard were held at First United Methodist Church in Little Rock. There was no mention of Leslie in her obituary. Instead, Janie's beloved dog, Gracie Mae, was named. On May 24, 2004, 27-year-old Leslie's solo trial began. Because Leslie admitted that she killed Janie, the trial was to decide why she did it, not if she did it. Mike didn't testify against Leslie because his trial was scheduled to begin a few months after. In fact, Mike's defense team attended Leslie's trial to see what the prosecution would possibly be doing for Mike's trial. Although Leslie had been charged with capital murder, the prosecution had taken the death penalty off the table. Janie's friend and neighbor, Mildred Cobb, told the Arkansas Democrat Gazette that Janie wouldn't have wanted Leslie to face the death penalty because she loved her that much. Leslie looked nothing like she did on September 12, 2003. Her bleach blonde hair was growing out and her dark roots were showing. She wore little to no makeup and dressed in plain colored clothing that hid her figure. It was clear the defense wanted to portray Leslie as the conservative Catholic girl she once was. The prosecution laid out the case for the jury. They said Leslie was going to try and say that Mike made her kill Janie, but that it wasn't true. Mike may have been an abusive guy, but he didn't make her do anything. Plus, there were plenty of times Leslie could have gone to the police and said Mike was threatening to kill her and her mother if she didn't carry out with this plan. But Leslie didn't go to the police, and that's because she wanted her mom dead too, the prosecution argued. She was very angry when she found out her mom had moved on quickly and felt that Janie erased Lester from the house. But she was even more angry when she found out her inheritance had been drastically cut down to $25,000. After reading the will, Leslie and Mike had found a loophole and realized they'd receive up to $2.4 million if Janie died within 30 days of Lester. So, they started planning Janie's murder together. The prosecution said Mike dropped Leslie off at Janie's house, and then Leslie waited in the bushes for her mother to come home. Once she arrived, Leslie ambushed Janie, and a struggle ensued. Leslie stabbed Janie a few times, and she fell face down on the ground. As Leslie straddled her mom, something inside her snapped. All the feelings of anger and betrayal she'd been holding on to came pouring out of her, and by the time she got a hold of herself, she had stabbed Janie more than 70 times. Leslie then staged the scene to look like a burglary gone wrong, but before she left, Leslie had done one more thing. She went back to Janie, the prosecution said, and for good measure, turned her over and slashed her throat. Then she met up with Mike, they covered up their crime, and waited for their payout. The prosecution told the jury what she wanted was money. What she wants now is pity. What she deserves is justice. Leslie had two defenses. One was the duress defense, which according to Justia, is where a defendant claims they had to commit the crime because if they didn't, they were facing the threat of imminent death or serious bodily injury. Basically, the defendant didn't have any other choice than to commit the crime. Duress as a defense has been around for centuries, but how the defense is interpreted by the law varies state by state. In some states, duress cannot be used as a defense if the defendant murdered someone. In other states, a defendant can claim they were under duress when they killed someone, but that doesn't mean they won't face a conviction. Instead of murder, most states reduce the charges to manslaughter. However, there is at least one state that does allow exoneration based on the duress defense, and that is the state of Arkansas. If authorities had believed Leslie's story about Mike forcing her to kill Janie, then they may not have charged her at all. But because they didn't, they charged her with first-degree murder, and if the jury believed Leslie's defense, then they would acquit her outright because she'd be not guilty. Leslie's defense tried to convince the jury that Leslie had to kill Janie or else Mike was going to kill her. She had no other choice. It was kill her mom or be killed. The defense said, quote, "Her dad's dead, her mother has been pushed out of her life, and she's got this psycho yelling in her head, 'You've got to kill her, you've got to kill her.'" The defense continued, "There's no question what she did was at his direction. He created this, he caused it, and he's responsible for it. It would never, ever, ever have happened without the poison, without the cancer in the Ballard family, known as Michael McCool." The second defense was that Leslie was not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect. She was an abused woman who suffered from anxiety and depression. The defense had psychologist Marilyn Hutchinson testify that Leslie exhibited the classic symptoms of an abused woman. She said, quote, "It was my evaluation that Leslie found that it was much easier to go along with things Michael dictated." Hutchinson also couldn't rule out that Leslie suffered from PTSD as a result of the abuse. To help corroborate Hutchinson's testimony, the defense had brought a neighbor to testify. He thought Mike physically abused Leslie because he often saw bruises on her arms and legs. They also had an ex-boyfriend testify that Leslie was afraid of Mike and had asked him to help her get away. Then, Leslie took the stand in her own defense. She started with her childhood, which she said was fraught with her parents' marital problems and alcoholism. But she was still close to them. Her mom was her best friend, and she never grew close to anyone else until Mike McCool, who was unlike anyone she'd ever met. Leslie said from the very beginning, Mike was controlling. He made her bleach her hair, get implants, and wear short skirts and tight tops. He wanted to know where she was at all times, told her when to go to the gym, and hit her if she didn't do what he said. When asked why she didn't leave, Leslie said, quote, "I was under the impression that no marriage is perfect. One of these days, I'll get everything right." She said she also felt like she didn't have anywhere to go, quote, "I felt like I was dumb enough to get myself in this situation with a man who beat me, and it was my responsibility to get myself out." Leslie said that Mike purposely formed a wedge between her and her parents and made her leave the job she loved. She told the jury she wasn't notified when her dad died because Mike had forced her to be estranged from her parents. Leslie said that as soon as she found out about her dad, she wanted to fly home from Florida immediately, but Mike wouldn't let her. Leslie admitted that when she went to her mom's on September 7th, she was very upset with how quickly Janie had moved on. But Leslie said she was not upset at all about her inheritance being lower. In fact, she claimed that she was elated to get that much because she could use the money to get away from Mike. Leslie testified that her last conversation with Janie was a positive one. She said she'd take care of Leslie if she left Mike. That insinuated that Leslie didn't need to kill her mom to get money, that her mom was going to take care of her as soon as she left Mike. Leslie said when she got home, she didn't tell Mike anything because she wanted to use the money to get away from him. The next day, she met with her dad's attorney and got a copy of the will. She hid it at home, hoping Mike wouldn't find it, but he did. He became enraged when he read that she'd only be getting $25,000. Leslie testified, quote, "He took it as a personal affront that I wasn't the main beneficiary in the will. He felt like my mom had gotten one over on him. He said, if it was my mother, I'd kill her." Mike read on and came to the fateful clause. He stopped and told Leslie that if Janie died within 30 days of Lester, Leslie would inherit everything. Mike started telling her that Janie had to die. Leslie said she wouldn't help him, and he slammed her against the wall and said, "If I tell you to fucking do something, you fucking do it, or I'll kill you first." Over the next few days, Mike planned Janie's murder and told Leslie what she was going to do. Leslie said, "He was a broken record. If I didn't do it, kill her and do it right, he would kill her and kill me too." A few days before the murder, Mike took her to Kmart and made her go inside and buy oversized boots while he stayed in the car. When Leslie's defense attorney asked why she didn't call the police while she was inside the store, Leslie replied, "I didn't see that I had any choice. It wasn't real to me. I didn't feel like anybody would help me." Leslie continued, saying that Mike woke her up that morning and said, "Get up, get dressed, and go do it." She said he dressed me like an infant in black clothes he had already laid out for her. Leslie insisted she didn't want to do it, but didn't know how to stop Mike. While she was waiting in the bushes, she said she was freaking out. She said, quote, "I didn't know how I'd gotten to this point. I didn't know how to get out of this situation. I didn't know how to get her out of this situation." Leslie's attorney said, "The situation was that you were going to kill her. You could have stopped." She replied, "He would have killed me." Her attorney said, "You could have given your life." Leslie said, "I know." And then paused and, fighting off tears, said, "I should have and wish I did." Leslie testified about how she ambushed her mom and stabbed her around 6 times before staging the burglary. She detailed what she and Mike did after and how when they got home from Hot Springs, investigators showed up. Leslie said that they allowed her and Mike to drive themselves to the station, and on the way, He repeatedly told Leslie not to mention his name. If she did, he would kill her. He also told her to act upset and be convincing. Leslie said that she was relieved to confess to investigators, quote, "Once the truth was out, it didn't really matter anymore." She had finally found a way to get away from Mike. When it came time for cross-examination, the prosecution really went at Leslie hard. They asked her about dressing up as a black woman when abandoning the car. They wanted to know what she would have done if an innocent person was arrested. Leslie said she would have risked being abused by Mike to come forward and clear them. The prosecution asked her why she wouldn't do that for her own mother, and she said she thought Mike would kill her. Trying to make everything seem like it worked out okay, Leslie quickly added that she confessed before police investigated anyone else. She told the prosecution that she confessed to her mom's murder because, quote, "the least I owed her was the truth." The prosecution fired back with, "Mrs. McCool, the least you owed her was to not kill her." Before they finished up with cross-examination, the prosecution asked Leslie about slitting her mother's throat. He said, "Those last injuries you gave your mom, those are for you, aren't they? You had already done what Mike wanted. Those were from you." Leslie still insisted she only remembered stabbing her mom 6 times. On May 28, 2004, after deliberating for 2 hours, the jury found Leslie guilty of capital murder and theft of property. She was immediately sentenced to life without parole for capital murder and 5 years for theft of property. When asked if she had anything to say, she said, "No, sir," quietly. Following the verdict, one juror told the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, "We just didn't believe her. There were too many opportunities for her to have gotten away from him. They believed Mike was abusive, but not to the extent you can murder somebody." Days later, the prosecution said they were no longer seeking the death penalty against Mike, and Leslie received the $25,000 payout from her dad's estate. But because she killed her mother, she was not eligible to receive a single penny from that estate, worth over $2 million. On October 25, 2004, Mike's trial began. He wore a gray suit, most likely a suggestion by his defense, so he didn't look so flashy. The prosecution told the jury, quote, "This trial is about two people who committed a horrific murder out of greed and anger." They said Mike was Leslie's behind-the-scenes accomplice in the murder and theft of Janie Ballard. The prosecution said if he had the option, Mike may have carried out the murder by himself, but he knew Janie was too scared of him, and he could never get close enough to her. Leslie had to do it. The prosecution had 3 people testify that prior to her murder, Janie said she was afraid that Leslie and Mike would kill her for her money. One friend said Janie was afraid both Leslie and Mike would kill her, but that she was mostly scared of Mike. Another said that Janie was scared of both Leslie and Mike. She was afraid of what they might do once Leslie read her dad's will. And the lawyer who handled Lester's estate said that Janie was extremely afraid of Mike, but never mentioned being scared of Leslie. Although she didn't have to, Leslie testified for the prosecution. She had cut off all her bleach blonde hair, leaving only the brown hair that had grown since her last dye job. She avoided looking at Mike while she recounted the same story she testified to at her own trial. Mike McCool did not testify on his own behalf. Instead, his defense told the jury that Mike didn't know Leslie was going to kill Janie when he dropped her off. The only role he played was helping Leslie afterwards. During their closing argument, the defense said, quote, "You don't talk someone into doing something that they don't want to do. Leslie was a powder keg." In rebuttal, the prosecution said Leslie was a powder keg. "But you know something about powder kegs? They don't go off by themselves. They need someone to light that match." On November 1st, the jury found Mike guilty of first-degree murder, not capital murder, and theft of property. He was sentenced to 40 years for first-degree murder and 20 years for theft of property to be served consecutively. Although the jury hadn't found Mike guilty of capital murder, the prosecution was still happy. First-degree murder was still a great conviction, considering Mike didn't actually kill Janie himself. As Mike was escorted out of the courtroom, he told reporters, "I tell you one thing, you don't make somebody kill somebody else." By March 2006, the Arkansas Supreme Court affirmed both Leslie and Mike's convictions and sentences. A few years into his sentence, Mike completed his GED. In 2018, he completed the Thinking Errors Group Program. Following that, Mike underwent a risk assessment and was eligible for minimum security. But less than 2 months later, he started racking up major disciplinary violations for things like possession or manufacture of contraband, out-of-place assignment, and lying. And within the year, he had been in trouble for battery, escape, contraband, under the influence, and more. He continued to break the rules and racked up more violations for disobeying orders, using things he wasn't supposed to, and contraband. After all this, Mike was no longer scored as a minimum security risk, and today, he is incarcerated in Varner Supermax in Gould, Arkansas. He is eligible for parole in October 2035, when he will be 82 years old. Today, Leslie is incarcerated in the minimum security McPherson Women's Unit in Newport, Arkansas. In the last 5 years, she's received 4 major disciplinary violations, 1 for theft or possession of stolen property, 2 for out-of-place assignment, and 1 for sexual activity. She will never be released from prison. I do believe Leslie's parents would not have wanted the death penalty for their beloved daughter, despite how viciously she killed her mother. But I'm pretty sure they would be okay with Mike McCool rotting in hell for eternity. Southern Fried True Crime is hosted and produced by me, Erica Kelly. Today's episode was written and researched by the amazing Haley Gray, with additional writing by me. Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio, and the original graphic art is by Coley Horner. A huge thank you to the Arkansas Democrat Gazette for their extensive reporting of this case. If you have any case suggestions, please visit my website, southernfriedtruecrime.com, and go to the Listener Suggestion tab. And if you have submitted a case suggestion in the last few months, please resubmit it on the website. I was very overwhelmed by email when I came back from my sick leave, and I've never caught up. This is the best way for me to get to those little-known cases y'all always send me. And come join our Facebook group, Southern Fried True Crime Fans Discussion Group, where we swap recipes, worship Dolly Parton, and share memes. Our group is a safe and fun corner of Facebook, and by God, we mean it when we say no shitasses allowed. It's not just a motto, it's how we run the group. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe, and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on most large platforms like iHeart, Stitcher, and Spotify. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.